Welcome to the Way Podcast on FM 91.7, WHUS Stores at the top of the hour. I'm your host, Bill Trofesky, and for more, be sure to go to podcasttheway.com. Again, podcasttheway.com, follow on Twitter, Instagram, social media. Okay, now that that's out of the way, how's it going today, Christina?
Good. How's it going for you? You've got a whole bunch of snow out there, I see.
Yep, got a nice little workout, shoveling the parking lot, all that.
fun, winter fun, you know?
Yep, when you're cooped up so much, it definitely makes you realize how out of shape you are.
Yeah, I bet.
Mm. But it helped out. And how about for you? Where are you located?
Well, right now I'm in Santa Monica, California, which is right next to LA, sort of a suburb of Los Angeles. So I'm about a mile from the Pacific Ocean. So it doesn't get too cold here, or today's actually sort of cold for Southern California winter, about 60 degrees, high 50s maybe. But it's sunny and it hasn't rained here in months. I mean, it just never rains here. It's just amazing.
Well, that's good to hear. In the future, one of the places I'm looking to move is California. California, Boston, New York City.
All very expensive cities, mind you.
That's true, too.
Expensive places.
Then everybody says you make more money, and that's true, but then you spend more money, so.
Yeah, it kind of evens out in the end, but but they're all, you know, happening places. I went to college in Boston. I went to Boston University, so it's a great town, and I grew up in, I went to high school in Northern New Jersey, next to about a half an hour from Manhattan, New York, so, you know, can't beat that, world city, New York City, and now I'm in L.A., so.
Nice. Boston University was one of those colleges I was looking at, and you guys are surrounded by, like, all of those other Boston colleges, which really tempted me, but the thing I didn't like was the campus. It was very, it's very spread out through the city.
Yeah, it's very urban and it's very, you know, it's not a campus per se. It's just sort of part of the city kind of thing. It's just an area that's a lot of BU buildings, you know. It's not a traditional campus. So
I ended up in the University of Connecticut, very out in the middle of nowhere. But let's get into today's topic. Speaking of places and places to live and whatnot, you were out in Venezuela for 7 years, was it?
I started my career in, as I said, I went to BU and then I came back to New Jersey and I worked at newspapers in local newspapers in New Jersey for about 5 years and I got bored. And so I went traveling, quit my job. And I went to Spain first, taught English for a year. I wasn't sure if I'd go back to journalism, but then I went to Guatemala and I did get back into journalism for an eccentric American woman ran a little English language weekly newspaper called the Guatemala News. And I got a job there and got back into covering really cool stories. And then after about a year there, ended up in Venezuela, where I ended up staying 7 years.
Well, nice. The newspaper part, on a completely different subject, I remember reading an article that a lot of like close newspapers or like little local ones are starting to die off. With people getting their news through TV and everything becoming on the computers and whatnot.
So hopefully. Oh, totally. Yeah, it's unfortunate, but yeah, it's just completely, the internet has just completely destroyed it.
And it's great because you can access like anything now. Like I can look at any article here and there, but then a lot of people see fake news spread, stuff like that. It just becomes, you gotta know
how
to use
it. Yeah, that's
a
whole other angle. Right, exactly. The whole misinformation stuff, but. You know, the challenge has been how to monetize news on the internet because there's so much available for free that people don't pay for it. And that's sort of was the downfall of newspapers. You know, they just became financially unsustainable. So it's a steadily shrinking field, unfortunately, but it was a great career and a great job. And I'm so happy I went into journalism. I still think it's a great career.
Nice. And have you, so after leaving the newspaper and living in Guatemala, have you written for anyone else recently? Or what have you been, before we talk about what we're talking about today, what other newspapers have you gone into? Or
what happened, I was working for local papers in New Jersey as a reporter and editor. And then, as I said, and then when I got to Caracas, I worked as a sort of a freelance foreign correspondent. They call them stringers. And I worked for Time Magazine, Business Week, New York Times. I wrote a lot for the Miami Herald, Houston Chronicle, Financial Times, Sunday Times of London, and just a whole bunch of other smaller, you know, a magazine called Latin Trade, business, a lot of business sort of industry type publications online and off, you know, I guess you call them hard copy, which, you know, weren't the most exciting things, writing about the Venezuelan coffee industry, but they always paid very well. But and then after I left Venezuela in 2002, after the coup, I was a reporter at the Miami Herald for 5 years. And then I came to L.A. and I worked for the Associated Press here for 5 years. And now I kind of freelance. I write fiction and I do a lot of corporate, like freelance stuff, which isn't very exciting, but it pays well. And then it leaves me time to do, you know, my passion, which is writing novels and I write a lot of personal essays, that kind of stuff.
Sounds good. Sounds like you enjoy writing.
Yeah, it's always been my ever since I was, you know, ever since I can remember, I wanted to be a writer.
Nice. Journalists, they always dive in on their topics. They, like, you spent years on your topics. So I like to think of you as almost an expert in your field. And then podcasters get to sort of take little bits here and there and then share mm-hmm. it to our field. Mm-hmm. You're like a translator.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, when you cover something as a journalist, you really have to, it's your, you know, quote unquote beat, they call it. You do become kind of expert in that particular area. And that's one thing I really loved about journalism is that you became kind of an expert of, you know, you had a lot of, a little bit of knowledge about a lot of things, you know, because you had to kind of bone up every time you wrote about a different thing. You'd have to find out the context, the history, who to call, you know, find out what was going on. So it was just something I always loved about journalism was just the variety of things that you were always writing about and learning about. It was always a learning experience.
Yep, same here. I love what I'm doing because I get to learn about all different topics from like death row to now 2002, Venezuela coup, Chavez, like complete, mm-hmm. Well, not complete different. I guess you can say that overlap. But yeah, this will be my third and final of the mini season that is Central America, South America, followed a kilo of Colombia in a kilo of cocaine, not kilo of Colombia, a kilo of cocaine in Colombia, followed MS-13. And now, yeah, the 2002 Venezuela coup.
Oh, but wait. I know Toby Muse, the author of Kilo, and I read his book and
oh, yeah, he was the one I had on the show, yep.
Yeah, I saw that, and I forgot to mention that to you. Yeah, because, you know, it was a small group of journalists, foreign journalists that covered Latin America, so we overlapped a little bit towards the end. But, yeah, it was a great book.
Sounds good. Kind of like me with the History Forager, where I found you on. But, all right, yeah, to get into 2002 Venezuela coup.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, also, hopefully, if you're talking with them all, hopefully they say good stuff about me. But yes. That's so wait, first, I say coup. It's pronounced coup, right?
Coup, yeah. It's actually a French word for blow, I mean, a coup d'etat, a blow of state, you know, a hit against the state. So it's a coup d'etat.
So a coup is coup d'etat. So basically, it's an uprising, sort of like a revolution in a sense.
Yeah, an overthrow, one would say.
And in 2002, you were in Venezuela for about 6.5 years at that point. What was life like before that event happened?
When I first got to Caracas, it was in 1995, and it was a very sleepy place. And Venezuela, it was a very nice place to live. Venezuelans are lovely people, very warm people. There was this doddering octogenarian president there, Rafael Caldera, and you know, just things were just, you know, muddled along, and it was a lovely, as I said, very pleasant to live. And then along came Hugo Chavez, who had actually been imprisoned for an attempted coup in 1992.
So he tried to overthrow the government that was in place?
Yes. Oh. Yes. He had tried, he was on a long-term sort of mission to instill, he was actually a leftist, which is very unusual. He was a military officer, very unusually for the military. He was a left-wing guy. One of his idols and mentors was Fidel Castro in Cuba. So he wanted to overthrow the, in 1992, the government then, and failed, and got thrown into prison along with all his coup plotters. And then, as I mentioned, this President Caldera actually pardoned him, and he was let out of prison, and he started building a political movement and traveled the country just building this this political movement. He called it the Revolutionary Bolivarian Movement. And what his platform was that corruption had actually robbed the Venezuelan people. Like many oil countries around the world, Venezuela is rich in natural resources and oil, natural gas, petrochemicals, gold, diamond, bauxite. It's got beautiful beaches where the tourism could be promoted, all that sort of thing. And but 58% of the population lived in poverty, and a good chunk of them lived in extreme poverty. And the country was sort of run by an elite, political and moneyed elite. A bunch of families owned most of the big businesses, that kind of thing, which is sort of usual in Latin America. How Latin America is kind of structured.
Aren't they the most corrupt, like, in the world? I remember hearing that with, like, the El Salvador one. They have, like, a huge issue with corruption, right?
Yeah, they all do. I think that the only country that's got somewhat of a better reputation is Chile. But I'm not an expert in Chile, and I haven't spent a lot of time there, so I don't really know. But that's always the one that sort of, signals, I guess, the most... a little more out of that corrupt sort of kleptocracy, you could call it, or elite oligarchy kind of a way of running things. So Chavez, being a leftist, wanted to instill sort of social justice. So in 1996, he started there was a presidential election coming up. He ran for president on a platform of a peaceful revolution. He had tried the violent revolution and didn't work in 1992. So in 1996, he was doing this peaceful revolution, and it worked. He was elected by a landslide. The poor of Venezuela loved him. They saw him as one of their own.
And they make up the majority, you said, like 53%.
Yeah, it was exactly a huge percentage. And he came from a plain state. He was a country boy. His parents were very modest school teachers who do not earn much money at all in a place like Venezuela. And he went into the military as his means of sort of breaking out of poverty. He was an extremely well-read and very smart man. And he had a master's degree in political science, and he loved political science. He read, if you spoke to him, he would just go on at length about, all kinds of political theory and stuff like that. He just loved that.
Yeah, he was a smart man, like he knew his stuff.
Yeah, yeah, he really had a great intellect, and he was very charismatic. I mean, he was just a born leader. I actually had the good fortune to interview him twice, and he was just a, everything else aside, he was just a fascinating individual. Again, I've never really met someone quite as charismatic. You just kind of fell into, sort of, he spellbound you. it's a really very rare personality type. So he was able to get people to follow him, in other words, he was definitely just a born leader.
Can you tell me a little bit about those interviews? Like, he was a charismatic guy. Anything big came up?
Not really. The thing that I interviewed him for Time Magazine twice. The thing is, with him, he would just go on and on, talking. You really couldn't get a question in. So it's actually kind of a tough thing to interview him, because he was a real talker.
I guess you get material though. So
yeah. Again, very interesting guy. He just had an answer for everything, and had really studied political theory and all kinds of systems all over the world and that kind of thing. So his thing, he wasn't going to do the socialist route, the communist route. He wasn't going to go the capitalist American route. He was going to do something down the middle. That's what he said. And Anyway, so he gets elected by a landslide. But very quickly, the upper classes of Venezuela, who controlled the media, they controlled all the big companies, banks, you know, all the big sort of the economic power of Venezuela, they were very frightened of him, actually. I mean, he represented a threat to their way of life and their money. They were afraid he was going to turn Venezuela into another Cuba. And Venezuela had a good, a sizable Cuban population who had fled Cuba after the Cuban Revolution in 1959, too. So they very quickly, as he began this huge project to remake the country from top to bottom, he called a constituent assembly to rewrite the constitution. He gave new rights to the indigenous groups. He was very in favor of the disenfranchised, such as the native groups in Venezuela. He rewrote the rules for unions, trade union, labor unions, which were very corrupt. Just everything, you know, from fishing rights, you know, the fishing laws, just laws, everything governing everything, got a do-over. So the elite did not like this because they were going to lose, you know, they were going to lose their power. So they became very entrenched. And as time went on, it just became really a polarized atmosphere against the pro-Chavez and the anti-Chavez people, who were basically poor, and the anti-Chavez were the rich, middle class and rich. So it became extremely polarized, and Chavez had this name for his opponents, the Los Escuálidos, the squalid ones, very odd name, but he would call them the squalid ones. He had these weird little nicknames for people who didn't follow his project and whatnot. So anyway, this went on, and then the society just grew, you know, more and more polarized. And there were all these sort of rumors that, you know, there was going to be a coup. And then, you know, even the military was split. There were some officers who were totally aligned with Chavez and many who weren't.
Was this census election or like close to 2002?
This was getting closer to 2002. Because he also, it started actually too, because he also used the military for his political purposes, and they didn't like that either. Being, you know, he started these, for example, he started like a markets for the poor people. So he would sell cut rate chicken and, you know, other staple goods, rice and what have you, from government stocks, and he would sell them at a subsidized price. And he used the military, he used his soldiers to go in and they would actually do the selling. So they were like, you know, we didn't join, you know, this is ridiculous. We shouldn't be, you know, selling stuff at markets. And meanwhile, of course, the private sector, the business people were like, hey, you're doing us out of business. You know, we're in business to make money. You know, and you're undercutting us. So that was how his things would sort of rub different groups up the wrong way.
I don't know too much, like, in general, like the overall history, but he kind of sounds like a good guy to me.
Yeah, I mean, he actually did do a lot for, he actually did reduce poverty in Venezuela, you know, by quite a bit. And he got people to credit, for example, credit cards were only something that the middle class or people who had means were able to obtain. You couldn't get a credit card if you were a working class person. He changed that. He made banks open up and give credit cards and things like that, and to regular people, you know, and that had never been done, things like that. So he sort of, and he had housing projects, you know, to build affordable housing and state housing, because people lived without running water in these, what, you know, Brazil they called favelas, in Venezuela they're called barrios, just, you know, sort of homemade brick houses just on the hills. You know, they would build these houses, but they weren't, there were no pipelines for running water, sewage, anything like that. You know, they would pirate electricity. They had no phone lines. So people were just mired in poverty with no way to get out of it. And that's what Chavez promised, was a way out of poverty. So it got very, very polarized. In 2002, things were getting really sort of tense, and there were a lot of rumors about a coup going to happen. Now, if in Latin America, particularly, to do a coup, you need the support of the military, because they're the ones who control the tanks and the guns. They've got manpower. So people wanted the upper crust wanted the military to act against Chavez, but they were not going to do anything like, you know, they didn't want to pull a coup.
Supported him, or like because of his military history, or just,
well, they wanted to keep the constitutional line, that they wanted to be constitutional, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to fall into, Venezuela had been a democracy since 1958, and they wanted to remain that way. You know, they were very they wanted to just be, you know, according to their purpose in the constitution, to national security or what have you. So they were, you know, to their credit, they didn't want to get too involved, you know, as happens in many other Latin American countries, the military gets politically involved.
And he was in the military prior, in the 1992, when he tried to do his own coup, the military sat out that one too.
Yes, he was a lieutenant colonel in a paratrooper battalion. Yeah, that's what he was.
So he wasn't able to use that influence in 92 that, like, he had to...
Yes, he got people, yes. And then, of course, he did have that. It was a smallish group of officers that followed him. It wasn't a huge... And of course, it ended in disaster and death. And that's also what made the Venezuelan military, they didn't want that again and didn't want to be blamed for that. So they were taking, you know, but, you know, again, the upper crust wanted them to act. This was all sort of going on in the background. And then the push came to shove when Chavez started meddling more in the National Oil Company, which is called Petróleos de Venezuela, one of the largest state-owned oil companies in the world. Venezuela has immense oil wealth, the largest reserves outside Saudi Arabia. Wow. And they had this very an impressive, everybody was proud in Venezuela of PDVSA, what they call PDVSA, this Petróleos de Venezuela.
So if they have all this oil, when does the USA come into play?
Yeah.
That's joke, because, you know.
Yeah, well, what had happened is the oil company, and this is what Chavez didn't like, the oil company had opened up, they had nationalized the oil industry in the 1970s, and they had kicked out all the American players and foreign players, but notably Exxon, some Standard, I forget who, they were the big oil companies were all kicked out, the mobile of the country. So in the late 90s, there became this move to get private investment back into Venezuela's oil industry. So there were people lining up from all over the world, you know, the European oil companies, American oil companies, and they were forming sort of joint partnerships with the Venezuelan company to, you know, extract very heavy crude, which is a very special technique to extract this. It's almost like tar, actually, extremely heavy crude oil. And Chavez did not like this. He thought that should be for the Venezuelan people. He didn't want the foreign, you know, influence back in this national oil company. That was what he called the patrimony of the people. So he wanted to exert more influence over the oil industry. He said they had too much autonomy. It was a state-controlled company, but they acted like they just did their own thing. And of course, that actually is what had made them a world-class company, because they were sort of above all the corruption and all the political interference that went on in many of the other Venezuelan state-owned companies. So Chavez wanted more influence in the company to get to get more control of it. So one day he had a Sunday morning radio show which was very popular. And he would just talk for hours and entertain call. People would call in with their problems and all kinds of things. So one day, this was mid to late April, he fired about a dozen top-ranking officials, executives at the oil company. And it was sort of stunning. You know, he was there sitting on his, it was a radio and TV show, and I was watching the show because he would always make news. So I would constantly have to, he would have to monitor. So the journalists always had to monitor that show because he would always say newsworthy things. And all of a sudden he starts firing people. Mr. So-and-so, you've served 22 years with Petróleos de Venezuela. Thank you very much for your service, but you can retire now.
Or and these people are just finding out watching this show.
Yeah. It was just, he just fired them on national television. Thanks very much, but you're fired. Don't come to work tomorrow. It was just kind of amazing. It was just like this stunning thing. But of course, people love this. You know, people, the pro-Chavez people were just like, yeah, you know, these elite people, they make all this money. They're stealing our oil wealth. But the people, the employees of the company did not like this. So
but did they like deserve to get fired or were they doing a decent job with what they were doing?
Yeah, they are opposed to him and the government having more sort of meddling in the oil company.
Which from that perspective, you could probably understand. Like if I was, I was running it, I'd want.
Yeah, and it was a big thing because, you know, Venezuela was very corrupt. It was all, you know, Venezuela had a bunch of different companies, state-owned companies that controlled aluminum, for example. And these were just filled with patronage jobs, no-show jobs. They were run by these corrupt labor unions. I mean, they were just, you know, really, really inefficient companies. But Petróleos de Venezuela was not like that. It was run like an American company or a European company, you know, and people were very proud of that. So they thought this was the beginning of the end. You know, now they were going to lose the oil company and this, and, you know, of course, Venezuela's prime earner of money. So they called a strike and basically, they just slowed down. People didn't work, and they just slowed down the oil industry to the extent they could. The refineries, it's very damaging to actually turn off a refinery, so they just slowed down production. The oil wellheads just slowed down production. The dock workers wouldn't load the tankers, you know, to export the oil. So there were just a growing number of tankers just anchored off the coast of Venezuela waiting to load their oil, and they could not. Because the workers weren't going to do it. And this went sort of, you know, got increasingly hard line over a couple days. Then the private sector, the business sector sort of joined in. They thought, oh, here's our chance. We're going to call a general strike. And a general strike is different. It's sort of like the opposite of like a worker's strike. In the general strike, the business owners don't open their businesses. So nobody can work. And basically it shuts down the country because you have, you know, the stores don't open, companies don't open.
So they're taking a hit. They're losing money, but again,
they are losing
working,
money.
So.
But yep, they thought this was worth it. And, you know, they had pretty good compliance with it. The business, you know, a lot of small business and big business went along with it. And, you know, but each day that it went over, so then they continued it, and then they continued. I think by the third day, you know, the business owners want to open again. They want to start selling their goods, and, you know, they're losing a lot of money. So on the Thursday, they organize the opponents to Chavez, organize a march through Caracas, and it was going to end in a rally, and it was an amazing thing. There were probably about 100,000 people turned out. It was just, you just filled one of the major thoroughfares in Caracas that day. And I went down to report on it. And, you know, people were singing and chanting and had their faces painted the national colors, red, yellow, and blue. And, you know,
this,
I mean, it was just like a
middle class, like upper businessmen,
yes,
doing this.
Yep. It was all the middle class, very, you know, the well-heeled people. So they, proceeded to launched off with this this huge march that went through the city. And then they decided to carry on, because it was such a success, to the presidential palace. And they were going to just rally out there. And the aim was, they were hopefully going to sort of get Chavez to just declare that, you know, he had lost control of the country. The country was so destabilized that he was going to resign and, you know, fly off into the night. But Chavez wasn't that kind of a guy, frankly. But anyway, so they go off marching along, and as with, they get closer to the presidential palace, the pro-Chavez people started amassing, and they were on an overpass where the anti-Chavez march was coming in under sort of this overpass, and the pro-Chavez people were on top of them. Then all of a sudden, shots started firing and ringing out, and people were just like, you know, dropping down. They were shot. All hell broke loose. There was chaos. Everybody was running for their lives. Then people started to fight back. They were throwing stones, throwing, picking up garbage cans, you know, what have you. It just turned into a huge riot, basically.
What side shot? Was it the military or one of the two sides?
Yeah, well, this is the interesting thing. So anyway, so everybody assumed sort of naturally that it was the pro-Chavez people were firing on the anti-Chavez people who were just marching peacefully and chanting, you know, which they were perfectly allowed to do under the in Venezuela democracy. So anyway, finally, there was a curfew call. They cleared the streets. The National Guard came out with tanks and started just clearing the streets and getting control again. Chavez went on TV and called for calm, that type of stuff. Then as the night wore on, then, you know, there were hundreds of people wounded. It turned out 19 people died. So as the night wore on, we're all at home because we're under curfew, we could see these generals going into the presidential palace on TV, you know, all because the TV was just full of the, you know, what had gone on. Everybody was just shocked. You know, how could Chavez order people, the army or the military, to fire on a peaceful march?
Yeah, this was huge for the country. Everybody's tuning into it.
Yeah, exactly. This was, you know, sort of this really shocking, shocking incident.
Also, wait, so before you go farther, were you, you were like living in the country, were you actually in the marches during this or were you nearby?
I was at home. I had filed a story and I was following it on TV at that point. At that point, the march had gone way further down than where I lived. So I was following it on TV. And I was sort of glad I did follow it on TV because, it did end up in a riot, and a news photographer did get killed actually. Ooh, wow. That day. So I'm, you know, everybody's watching this. About 2 a.m., a general comes on the TV and he announces that Chavez has resigned. And this is a general who actually was a Chavez general. You know, he was his right-hand man, this general. So everybody's in shock. So we go to bed about, you know, whatever, and that's all he said. He has resigned. So the next day, I woke up early and, you know, I went outside and it was like this sort of weird sensation. It was just like the whole city was just silent. It was like this deathly silence. Everybody had just been so shocked about the events of the previous day, and then Chavez had resigned. So as the day wore on, so then the opposition starts saying, hey, we won, we're going to install a new government, we're going to have a civilian military junta and then call new elections. So that day, and they had all these plans, they had, you know, planned for this new government all along. They swore in a new president who was actually a business owner, the head of the business, National Chamber of Commerce.
So the opposite of Chavez.
Right, exactly. And the first thing he did was dissolve Congress and the Supreme Court. So basically, which again was another really shocking move, because basically he set himself up as a dictator. He had just dissolved the two branches of government. Meanwhile, all this, the pro-Chavez people were like, where's, number one, where's Chavez? Is he dead? Is he alive? Is he taken prisoner? Where is he? Just disappeared. And number two, where's the resignation letter? Where has he resigned? So the attorney general went, told a press conference, and he said, this is a coup. And he called it, and he said, this is nothing but a coup. And he said, according to the Constitution, if Chavez has resigned, the vice president should be president, which, you know, he was right. But, you know, the opposition was just so, you know, enthralled that Chavez had resigned. The Bush government in Washington immediately recognized this new government, so on and so forth. But meanwhile, people were getting, the pro-Chavez people were really like, you know, what the hell's going on? And looting started and, you know, riots started. There were hot tires burning in the streets, the cars set on fire. Businesses, you know, broken into. People were started to gather at the local, there was a military base just south of Caracas there, and yelling at the military, where's Chavez? Where's Chavez? Where's Chavez? Yeah. And so this went on into Saturday. Meanwhile, there was sort of this really ugly side of sort of vengeance of the winners, you know, and the elite people were running around. They gathered outside the Cuban embassy and they wanted the Cuban diplomats were hiding inside, you know, and they were climbing over the wall. They wanted those Cubans out. They wanted them out of Venezuela. And, you know, they were trying to cut off the electricity and water to the embassy. Wow. So, I mean, it was just like this really weird, as I said, that, you know, ugliness, vengeance of the winners, and people were, they were going around to the homes of the Chavez ministers, the cabinet ministers, and pulling them out and saying, you're under arrest for, you know, basically nothing.
And all this is the next day.
This was like the next day. This was Friday and Saturday, next 2 days. By the end of Saturday, though, people were starting to, you know, there was international pressure, too. The Organization of American States said, well, wait a minute, we, you know, where is Chavez and where is his resignation letter? We want, you know, we want to see this. What's going on there? So there's international pressure started to build. Some people were calling CNN in Espanol in Atlanta, Georgia. It denounced, this is a coup. This is a coup. You know, including Chavez's daughter, you know, she said, my father is gone, he's missing, you know, where is he? This is just a coup. So this tide sort of started to return by late Saturday and into Saturday night. Eventually, the new government realized this wasn't going to hold. They were on really shaky legal ground. And the other thing was the military didn't like what the new president, Carmona, had done. He hadn't kept to the Constitution. You know, he dissolved Congress and the Supreme Court. So they were like, well, what's going on here? We didn't, you know, get rid of Chavez to put a dictator in. So they were pressuring this new government. And as I said, the international pressure was growing. So eventually, it's sort of, I think, late Saturday night, the tide started to turn, and they realized this was untenable, and they all went, like, fled the palace, and it was actual, like, takeover. Then the Chavez ministers, like, plotted to retake the palace using this underground tunnel into the palace, and they actually got some soldiers and whatnot and they all, like, stormed into the palace and retook the palace, and the other people had... Yeah, I mean, it was just
like
crazy.
A chaotic mess everywhere, like this whole story.
Yeah, so the other, you know, the new cabinet, the new government people, they've all just like fled. They knew this was, you know, untenable. So by Sunday, they were looking for the vice president, Chavez's vice president, who had gone into hiding, you know, because he thought he saw everybody getting pulled out of their houses and then was afraid. So they had to find him and bring him back in. And, I think they swore in, actually, I think at that point they swore in, I think he was the former, the head of the National Assembly.
I was going to say quickly, that ambulance makes it kind of eerie as you just talk about this overthrowing, this chaos, all this stuff.
I know, the siren. I live between two hospitals. It's really kind of a noisy location sometimes. So anyway, so now there was he had another president in. Then they found the vice president, finally brought him in, swore him in as the legit president, interim president, while they located Chavez. Finally, they found him. He was prisoner, being held prisoner on a small, tiny little island off the Venezuelan coast. There was a small Navy base there called Orchila Island. And by the end of Sunday, you know, they were trying to get government back in, and Chavez came flying in on a helicopter and greeted this. Thousands of people had surrounded the palace at that point waiting for him, and the helicopter landed, and then he came out on a balcony and greeted the, you know, the people to a roaring cheers. So that was the coup, you know. It was like this four-day coup. And it was just crazy. In the following days, that wasn't the end of the story, though. It emerged that the people who had fired those initial shots on the marchers were hardline right-wing people who were snipers, and it was a military sort of set up. They had put snipers on these big buildings, you know, like office buildings, to fire on the crowd to create chaos or to convince the military to act and move against Chavez.
So they shot at their own people.
They shot at their own people, right.
Wow, because yeah, I forgot. You never, like you said, everybody thought it was the pro-Chavez people that shot, and then you like kept going on in the story. It's like, wow.
So right, because that was a natural assumption. It's like, you know, you wouldn't assume that the same side was shooting on you, you know, and there were all these people gathered on this overpass, and, you know, so people thought they were shooting and all this. But it actually turned out that it was this very, you know, hardline right-wing element in the military who wanted to take back, you know, the government from Chavez, and they had set this whole thing up.
And if they control the media too, they could like press it on like, oh, look, the pro Chavez are like shooting at us. Plus,
oh yeah, that's and that's what happened. The media, because it was owned by a lot of, you know, very wealthy families, and they were largely against Chavez. They just, you know, when this happened, it was just they hammered, that was the nail that they kept hammering on, you know, after the march and into the night, and this happened, and how could he have done this? And he was supposed to be the people's president, and he fired on a peaceful march. They were constitutional, exercised their constitutional right. This is a democracy, blah, blah, blah. So that was this constant thing over the, you know, over the airwaves. And it turned out, yeah, it was all a big, big setup. It was a really, really, the word that comes to mind is dastardly move, you know. It's just a very evil sort of a thing. So that's why I think after that, the opposition to Chavez just sort of really, it was, you know, so ashamed. I mean, it was such a shameful thing to do. They've never really recovered. You know, they're just not very strong. You know, they still haven't.
Were able to get him out. Huge bombshell.
Like, yeah. So that's the story of the 2002 coup, but. And it was just crazy for me. I was, you know, my phone was ringing off the hook from people that, you know, wanted to know what was going on from different media outlets. And I was on the radio and, you know, filling in different reporters. And because it was just a constantly changing situation at that point.
I bet,
people
yeah,
couldn't get in. The airport was closed. You know, I learned a lot about how to do a coup, actually. You know, you have to get control of the ingress and egress of the country, shut down airports and the borders. You have to get control of the media and start, like, you know, putting out the mass media, you know, on radio, TV, putting out your propaganda. And, of course, you know, get the military.
So if you want to start your own, you know exactly what to do.
Right. I know what to do. It's coup, control. It was coup 101. Yeah. Yeah. And you kind of have to, and again, I think that the big thing was it might just have worked, I guess, if Carmona hadn't done that move with the, you know, dissolving Congress and the court, but it probably would have lasted a little bit longer. But, you know, again, the tide was, the whole legality of it was so suspect because there was no resignation letter. And then it turned out that there was no resignation letter. He had never officially resigned. And that was the other thing too. He verbally said he would resign because he was getting pressured. This is what he said later, but he never signed anything. He said, I never signed anything.
So it was never official. That's why.
He never. Right. Exactly.
I heard also while he was in prison, he wrote down, I never resign or something similar like that, and then threw the paper in the trash can.
Yes, he left. He left a message there. He wasn't sure when later on he said, you know, I thought when they were taking him to this island, he said, I thought they were going to push me out of a helicopter. You know, he's like, this is it. They're just going to push me into the sea because that had been done in Argentina. You know, they would do that with political enemies during the 1980s. The army would just take people, you know, in a helicopter and just, you know, push them overboard. He said, I didn't know if I was going to live.
Wow. That's harsh, yeah. Too. Not even like I feel like it'd be easier to have a line up and just have them get shot. That's like, if you survive that, that's a bit much.
Yeah. Pretty brutal.
Which I was going to ask too, why not do an assassination or execute it? Wouldn't that have been easier for the people trying to run the coup?
You know, perhaps. And again, Chavez claimed that he had uncovered, and actually the current president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, you know, every so often he'd claim that they had uncovered this assassination plot. But they never named names or details. It always seemed very sort of just a propaganda type thing. But yeah, I'm sure they considered many things, but they were trying to do it under this guise of sort of like, you know, some sort of constitutionality, like the military acted because they wanted constitutional order and they felt Chavez had violated human rights and violated the constitution by ordering, you know, the marchers shot. That's, you know, they wanted to create this veneer of constitutionality about it.
They would have lost their quotation, moral high ground.
Right, exactly. They wanted to keep that moral high ground, which, you know, actually turned out to be extremely low.
I mean, you're showing it to your own crowd? Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's a pretty, pretty evil sort of a plot.
And did that work? Like you said, they wanted to do that to try to bring the military in. Did that end up bringing the military in, or did they still?
It did. Yeah, it certainly did. You know, and they got the generals, you know, that's why the generals went to visit Chavez that night and, you know, were pressuring him to resign and said, listen, you did this, you ordered the military, the National Guard or whoever it was to shoot on this, you know, you don't deserve to be president. You know, you can't violate the Constitution. So it did prove to be the lever. And of course there were people, you know, there was circles of generals aligned with this who were pushing that, you know, within the military, within the generals as well, saying we can't allow it, you know, we've got to move against him, we've got to move against him as part of the plot to instigate the move. So yeah, you couldn't make this stuff up, really. So it was an incredible time, and I think that was the best story I've ever covered in my journalistic career was the coup.
I mean, you were there, like, perfect timing.
it was something.
Yeah, like while you were in there, you want to stay safe, but were anything you can tell me about like being on the ground in that country during that time?
Yeah, you just had to, you know, just say you were oppressed. They didn't have a lot, you know, actually Venezuelans were very pro-American and European. And Chavez started to turn, that tide started to turn. He, you know, hated Bush and he would always call the imperialist Yankees and that kind of thing. But still, I never felt threatened or afraid in Venezuela. I really didn't.
Did you see any of like the looting or riots around you, or were they in like different towns over?
They were in different sections of the city. I did see them, you know, because I was driving around trying to get, you know, what was going on the ground. So I was driving around and trying to look at what was going on. So I did see them, yeah. You know, guy, young men with sort of the t-shirts over their heads, so you could in disguise, so, you know, just their eyes were peeped out and they were running around saying, where's Chavez? You know, we want Chavez, and burning tires in the street and that kind of thing.
Wow. And also, I heard that Chavez, he called up Castro as, like, before he finally lost power for those 5 days, he called up Castro to ask his opinion on what he should do.
Yes. Yes, he did. Yeah, he did, apparently. Yeah, he called him, and he called the Catholic bishop, actually, one of the bishops that he wasn't a friend of the Catholic Church, but the bishop came. He trusted him as a mediator. He would be like a sort of a mediator between the military pushing him to leave. And he did call Fidel Castro, and that's right. You know.
So how did, like, I was young, I was maybe 5, 6 at that time. How did the world react to this from, like, yeah, how did the world react?
Yeah, I think everybody was pretty shocked, you know. And Venezuela is a world oil player, so this affected world oil markets and all that sort of thing. So it had that that effect. So it was an important thing to pay attention to. And it had been a democracy for a long time. And was a stalwart, you know, democratic influence in Latin America, actually. So this was really, you know, quite a shock. But, you know, again, there had been that coup attempt, Chavez's previous coup attempt in 92, and different things that had gone on there, instability. But, yeah, people were pretty shocked, yeah.
And the U.S. endorsed the new president.
Yes, and that, of course, was highly embarrassing to the Bush government when it it turned out that actually they were the first ones to recognize the new government, and then it turns out it was all an illegitimate government and a complete farce of a coup plot. But again, that was one of the reasons why the opponents had to create this veneer of constitutionality over this sort of overthrow, so they could get so. Countries like the United States would recognize them. You know, if it was a clear-cut, sort of military coup and blood in the streets, nobody's going to recognize them. You know, it's at that point. So they had to create this facade to gain international support. That was the other,
Yeah, you got put up that fake image, sort of. I see that.
Right, that, it was Chavez's fault. He was he had violated human rights and fired on his own people and blah, blah, blah.
And after he comes back, he takes his power back. How did he react? Did he throw anybody in prison or anything, or did he sort of try to kick them back?
Well, his big line was, I have to, I made a mistake. I have to govern for all people. I have to bring them, this is a time of reconciliation and peace. And again, he was very clear about just governing for, his people were the poor people, and he didn't really care about the rest. So he sort of made these very conciliatory remarks, but, it didn't last long. I mean, it was just back to normal and back to business as usual. And then he became actually much more hardline leftist and socialist, and began saying he was on a socialist agenda. He forgot about this, medium striking a middle ground kind of line. And after that, he became much more hardline.
So it likely radicalized him.
Yes, it sort of radicalized him.
And they just start to try to take more control of everything, like the oil and secure everything, and kind of overdid it by that point.
Yeah, he kicked out the foreign oil companies, did get kicked out again. He nationalized a lot of businesses, basically did kind of follow the Fidel Castro playbook.
Gotcha. And how long did he rule too? And like, what's the final end of his presidency?
Well, he actually died in office. He, it was 2010, he had cancer. What was odd, they never announced what kind of cancer it was. He went for treatment in Cuba a couple times for, I guess, some kind of radiation or whatever, but they never really said what, his cancer was. They said it was something in the abdomen. So it was always this hush-hush thing. So he died in office, which sort of made him even more of a myth than a legend. Because that was the other thing, that, after the coup, he became stronger than ever in the eyes of his supporters. They were, convinced he was there was nothing that was going to knock him down. You know, he tried, but they couldn't do it. He came back, you know, the cat with nine lives kind of thing. And then when he died, he sort of handpicked his successor, which was this guy, Maduro, who was a former bus driver and leader of a bus driver's union. And Maduro is still in power today, and the country is a nightmare. It's just a basket case. 5 million people have left, many who could, to Miami, to Colombia. There's people just walking, trying to get out. There's no food. Electricity is in short supply, a lot of electricity rationing. It's just a shame. It's just an absolute nightmare.
So what I hear is they used to have the third biggest economy, lots of oil. Chavez comes, like, they had a lot of poverty, so it sounds good that he helped them out, started putting some new policies in tech, but then he becomes radicalized. And so what finally resulted in what you just said, like, now from third richest to now pure poverty and everybody's leaving?
Yeah, I think, well, number one, he did not stamp out corruption. I don't know, there's no sort of evidence that Chavez himself was personally corrupt, although there may be that I don't know of, but people around him certainly were. And they started, again, you know, looting the coffers of the Venezuelan government for themselves, doing all kinds of schemes and kickbacks and all kinds of things. Another thing that the military started allowing the Colombian guerrillas and cocaine cartels to use Venezuelan territory as a transshipment point, and they would pay off, the Venezuelan government people or whoever to look the other way, you know, as to use Venezuela as a transshipment point. Just vast economic mismanagement, just absolute mismanagement. And the more, you know, I mean, it's sort of like many socialist countries that nationalize a lot of businesses, the businesses just, you know, fall to pieces. I mean, they're just not well run. They become like, you know, political patronage deposits. You know, people just use them for their own ends, to enrich themselves. And I think that's just what happened. I mean, there was no investment back in the oil industry. Well, you know, one of the things that the oil industry had, they would put a lot of money back into the oil industry to, you know, do further exploration, do maintenance, you know, all that equipment and refineries need a lot of maintenance. They just didn't do that. They just took the money and gradually, you know, disintegrated.
So they're the most corrupt in the world, that whole area. America, we have our own little bits of corruption. I mean, we're still nothing like that, but we still have our own little bits here and there. Mm-hmm. And we're a great economy powerhouse, like in the whole world. We're top tier. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're some of the most unequal, where you see, I saw a thing, the stock market, 0.01%. Well, the bottom 50% of the population owns 0.07% of the stock market, or some minuscule. There's some whole, like, the top 1% have made this increase while the bottom 50% has lost $500 billion, stuff like that. So is there a way to sort of flatten that out, like Chavez wanted to do with his country, without having us turn into his country?
Well, there's no question that the United States is getting more of an unequal society, and an inequitable society. It's getting harder to do the traditional thing of, you know, doing better than your parents did, you know, your dad did, kind of a thing. It's not that true anymore. I think the whole pandemic has highlighted that too. The haves and the have nots, the type of jobs, and the lack of social safety net. In Europe, they do not have the vast, inequitable wealth. There's certainly wealthy people and poor people, but there's much more of a social safety net. Whereas, for example, you know, they have national health, Everybody has healthcare, you know, the government provides healthcare. Here, that's not the case. A lot of people don't have good healthcare, and things like that. There's more housing, you know, subsidized housing for people. Here, you know, it's in great, great demand. You know, any kind of government housing program is the demand far outstrips the supply. So all these kind of social supports that could support a more equitable society, we don't have here. It's a much more individualistic, sort of pull yourself up by the bootstraps type of society. And it's getting increasingly hard to do that, though.
Gotcha. Makes sense. All right. Well, I think gonna end it there. There is one more question I forgot to say before, but when Chavez was on the news saying, like, you're fired, you're fired, you're fired, I heard he was wearing, like, a referee outfit, and he had a whistle, and he would, he would blow
yes,
it.
Yes, I'd forgotten that detail. That's absolutely, yes, he had a whistle, and so he would blow his whistle, blow the whistle like a referee whistle and say, you're out, you know. He was actually a huge baseball fan, you know. Yes, he would blow the whistle and say, you know, like, you're out, you're fired, and the whistle would go. That's true. Yeah, I mean, it just added to the circus, you know, this bizarre circus atmosphere.
That's the beginning of the chaos, I guess.
Yeah, that's what sort of tipped it off. Yeah, that was sort of the tipping point. And again, it was an extreme action, you know, done for theater more than anything. But that tipped off the strike, that tipped off the oil worker strike, that tipped off the, you know, general strike, that tipped off the huge march, and then, you know, this plan that moved into action.
Whatever side you're on, well, if you're pro-Chavez in the country at that time, and I see him doing that, I'm thinking, wow, this guy's a legend.
Exactly. It just, you know, cemented him as a legend, yeah. Myth.
Yeah, it's just one of those, like you said, it's yourself, like one of those things for show. That's just like, mm-hmm. Wow, this guy. Like, even in, like, America, Donald Trump, yeah, I'm not going to get political, but not too fond of him. Mm-hmm. But he'll do a little thing here and there that I'm like, that doesn't help the country, but, you know, that's kind of cool. I'll give him that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty fun. I did actually write a piece about comparing Chavez and Trump. I wrote an article. It was actually a lot of fun to write, and, you know, completely antithetical, you know, politically, one's, you know, right and one's left, but a lot of similarities in the way they governed, you know, and do things and behave. So
is there some kind of horseshoe theory to it, where, like, you're so far away that you eventually come back around?
Yeah, that's what I would say, exactly. When you're at the extreme of either, you know, political end, you're actually very much alike. Sort of like a big circle, you know.
Sounds good. What's the name of that piece again?
It's just called, what is it? The Autocrat's Playbook, 8 Parallels Between Trump and Chavez. It's on my medium.com site, so I can send you a link.
Sounds good. I'll put a link in the description for the show, yeah. With your website, yep. Too. Is there anything, I'll say a final question, but first, is there anything for the audience for where to find you?
You can look me up on my website at christinahoge.com, and there's, you know, more about me and the novels I've written, and some links to articles and readings and all that kind of stuff.
Sounds good. And yeah, for the audience, you'll see that in the description. But first, what's the final message or the final thing you want to tell the audience?
Well, it's very dangerous to be to have a polarized society, and that's where I fear we're going. And that's, I think, the legacy of Trump, is that he has really polarized the political society, political atmosphere in the United States. That we're now, it's just become, there's almost like no middle ground. I mean, you know, even on COVID pandemic relief, you know, both sides can't even seem to agree on that. And it's dangerous. It's a really dangerous precedent.
Yeah. We're still one country. We don't need a civil war or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, thank you again very much for coming out to the show.
No, well, thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me. And, hope you enjoyed it.
Sounds good. I definitely did. And for the audience, this was, again, the 2002 Venezuelan coup. FM 91.7 WHUS stores at the top of the hour. For more, go to podcasttheway.com, follow on Twitter, Instagram. This is my first time saying it, but give it a 5-star on Apple Podcasts if you can. Let me see if that does anything. Again, podcasttheway.com. And as always, deuces.